So that's the taking control part. Okay? First three verses. Nagarjuna lays out how, you know, that karma works. Karma definitely works. Definitely believes. Nagarjuna definitely believes in the efficacy of karma. He lays out, like, you know, the importance of intention, and he lays out, you know, three guidelines for what our intention should be. To restrain ourselves from selfish, egotistical, hurtful actions of body and speech and mind, and to, you know, think about other people and their welfare, to have a beneficial, beneficent, you know, kind of mindset about other people, and maitri, to have love in your heart. Okay? That's the first part. Now, the illusion of control. The illusion of control. The rest of the chapter problematizes the idea that how karma works is intelligible to us. Okay? Karma does work. But can we understand it? Can we know it? And if, of course, we can know it, then we can control it. You see? In fact, knowledge is a form of control, isn't it? Intellectual knowledge is a form of control. So we want that. Just like we want control over in other regards, we definitely want intellectual, knowledge that will help us control our lives and the world around us. So that's going to be the problem. That's an illusion. It is an illusion that we can control, that we can know how to control the future. The future will be the result of previous causes. No one denies that. Nagarjuna is not denying that. And we can control our motivation. We can control our intention. We can control our heart. But how karma works, Nagarjuna is going to show, is unintelligible to us. Which kind of takes us down a few notches, I would say. When it comes to hubris, when it comes to arrogance, you know, there's no arrogance like intellectual arrogance. There's no arrogance like thinking that you know for sure how things are, or who another person is, or, you know, what will happen in the future, or what the weather will be for present. Okay? There's no arrogance like that. That's just, like, absurdly arrogant. Okay? And Nagarjuna is going to provide us with some handy-dandy insights as to how we can get over that arrogance when it comes to causality and to karma in general. All right, 17.6 is one of the more important verses of the chapter 2. Because here he lays out the problem. You know, the problem with karma. And this is a problem that, you know, it's not only Nagarjuna has noticed. This is the problem, you know, that arises for anyone who tries to, you know, figure out how karma is going to work. And most especially in a Buddhist context, I would say. So let's go. If karma continued on until it ripened, if the cause, the karmic cause, continued on until the result occurred, it would then be permanent. The word he uses here is nitya, which, if you know, like, anything about Buddhism, you know, the Sanskrit, nitya is like absolutely impossible for almost everything in Buddhist thought. Nothing is permanent. In fact, one of the what they call lakshanas, one of the signs, great signs of, you know, kind of Buddhist orthodoxy, is that everything is anitya. Anitya means impermanent. So he's saying if the cause continued on until it ripened, it would then be permanent, because the cause would not change. It would be there when the result occurred, right? The cause would persist up until the time, unchanged, up until the time, and even after the time of the result. And that's impossible. It's impossible for all kinds of reasons. We can see it even in the most ordinary, you know, kinds of examples. A seed does not persist once the sprout has sprouted. The seed ends when the sprout comes. You see? So the cause is not there when the result occurs. Okay? Cause doesn't persist. Here's another way to think about it, okay? If the cause persisted unchanged until the time of the result, it would be impossible to tell cause and effect apart. Okay? Because they would be there at the same time. You see? A cause is a cause because it brings about an effect later. Okay? So he's eliminating one possibility here for, you know, how karma works. Karma can't, the karmic cause cannot remain unchanged until the cause, karmic effect occurs. Because then it would have some kind of permanence to it. And if it ceased, he says, if it stopped, how, having stopped, could it bring about its result? So the other shoe drops. If the cause isn't there at the time of the result, then how can you say that the cause brought about the result? It's not there, you see? If the cause has ceased to exist by the time of the result, then there's no intelligent way that you can say that a cause, which is no longer there, brought about somehow its result. This is the problem of karma, okay? This is the problem of karmic causality, right there. Very succinctly put. And then, you know, lots and lots of ink gets spilled over how to solve this problem. This problem about karma. And it's a problem that anyone can, you know, kind of come to with just a little bit of analysis on how it is that we think karma works in terms of the relationship between cause and effect. Here's another, dimension of the problem that's kind of implied here, and that he does address at various later points in the text. This is a Buddhist problem. This is a problem that I was faced with when I was teaching in Germany one time at a yoga studio. You know, wearing Buddhist monks and everything, talking about karma, and then some German wise guy yogi raises his hand and says, but you Buddhists don't believe in a self. You believe in no self, which is actually a second of the three lakshanas of Orthodox Buddhism. Anicca means impermanence. Anatman means no self. So every Buddhist school believes in these things. So I'm sitting there wearing Buddhist robes talking about karma and how, you know, you better watch out. Because if you create karmic causes, you'll receive karmic effects and so forth. And this wise guy, German guy, you know, raises his hand and says, well, what, you don't believe in a self. So how can you believe that there's some kind of continuous entity between the cause and the effect? The cause, the maker of the karmic cause is not the same as the recipient of the karmic result, because there is no continuous, unchanging self that would persevere over time. This is quite true, actually. You know, that is true. And it's not like this German wise guy yogi thought, the first time that anyone has ever thought about that problem. You know, for millennia, you know, Buddhists have wrestled with this problem of, like, how to maintain a doctrine of no self at the same time of maintaining a doctrine of karmic, you know, responsibility. And Nagarjuna comes back to it later. All right. So, you know, the karmic cause is neither permanent nor annihilated. Sometimes they use that word, annihilated. It's neither ongoing in an unchanging way or just stops, just, you know, kind of like disappears. So there's got to be, like, some solution to this problem, you know. Where is karma stored over time? It's another way of talking about the same problem. And as maybe some of you, Buddha heads know, like some of the Buddhist schools even invented a separate part of our consciousness called the storehouse consciousness, where karma could be stored. This is not Nagarjuna's position, because that also smacks of nitya, of permanence, you know, some kind of permanent, you know, storehouse with permanent, like, unchanging seeds in there, like a silo with a bunch of wheat grain or something like that, all of which just are waiting to, you know, pop later on. That's not going to be Nagarjuna's solution. But it is the point is that this is a general problem. It's a general problem in Buddhism, and Nagarjuna has put his finger right on it. And the other answer, another possible answer, that karma is that there is no relationship between cause and effect, Nagarjuna finds totally absurd. That things could just happen for no reason. So we can eliminate that one, you know, even though it's, you know, not spoken here. He thinks that that's kind of the height of ignorance, to think that things just happen for no reason. 17:13. Oh, so between 6 and 13, Nagarjuna explores other schools' attempts to answer this, other Buddhist schools' attempts to answer this. And I've gone into detail on this, you know, in the past in teachings, and if you're really interested, you can access my Middle Way Center course on the emptiness of causality, where I did a verse-by-verse, over two classes, actually, verse-by-verse analysis of this 17th chapter. But I'll just give you the, you know, Cliff Notes version of what he does between 6 and 13. He analyzes a school that says there is a continuity between karmic cause and karmic effect. There is some kind of continuity, which, you know, the word is sankhana, which, you know, I can't figure out a better English word to say than continuity. There's something that stretches over and bridges between the karmic cause and the karmic effect. So that school thinks that that's somehow going to get them off the hook of the problem here. Of like, is the karmic cause unchanging and permanent, or is it, you know, kind of annihilated at the time of, you know, at the time of its end? You know, you create a cause and then the cause ends. Does it just go away then? And so they said, no, there's this continuity. And Nagarjuna in 1712, which I haven't given to you, says, if one posits this, many great errors would occur. Many great errors. And one of the great errors that would occur is that there is no so-called continuity of karma without a continuity of the bearer of karma, of the person who has the karma, who has created the karma and will receive the karma. There's no continuity of that because of no self, anatman. The self is the so-called self is constantly in flux, okay? There is no permanent, unchanging self. This is a truism, an axiom in Buddhism. So that's one of the great errors that would occur if you start, you know, positing continuity. Here's another one, okay? Continuity assumes that there are discrete moments that are continuous, right? Moment X is followed in a continuous kind of, string, with moment Y, which then leads to moment Z, and so forth. And Nagarjuna himself has analyzed, you know, the notion of time in other chapters. And there is no discrete moments of time findable, okay? Every moment of time has a beginning, middle, and end, in order for it to be a moment of time. But every beginning of a moment of time itself has a beginning, middle, and end. And every beginning of a moment of time itself has a beginning, middle, and end, and down you go the rabbit hole. There's no findable, indivisible moments of time. So how can there be continuity? All right, just a quick summary of why he doesn't, you know, kind of adhere to this idea that other schools have posited. Then he says in 1713, I will now explain the appropriate conception. Which is very unusual in Nagarjuna's text. I've translated all the chapters of this 27-chapter, masterwork of Nagarjuna's. And I don't recall another instance in the whole text where he uses the first person. I will now explain the appropriate conception. The reason I'm emphasizing this is because many commentators on this text, modern commentators on this text, do not believe that this is Nagarjuna, that Nagarjuna's position begins here. They do not believe it. They think, no, he's just gonna talk about somebody else's position again. And indeed, many times it's very difficult to determine when Nagarjuna is giving his own position and when he's just talking about somebody else's that he doesn't agree with. Sometimes it's very difficult. But why would he use the first person pronoun if he wasn't giving his own position here? I will explain the appropriate conception, which has been propounded by the Buddhas, the self-made Buddhas, the Pratyeka Buddhas, and the listeners, the Shravakas. Okay? Now he's calling up the big boys. You know, I, Nagarjuna, will explain the one that the Buddhas taught, the one that the, you know, self-made Buddhas taught, the one that the listener, all these guys in Nirvana, you know, and awakening have all taught this conception. That's what he seems to be saying in this verse, okay? So I'm just, you know, pointing out, like in case somebody's interested, actually interested enough to go study this chapter and look at other commentators on it, I'm just pointing out that, you know, my choice here is not the choice that everyone has made. That other commentators do not believe that this is Nagarjuna's position. But like I said, it seems kind of hard to say it's not Nagarjuna's position when he uses the first person pronoun like this. Okay? So I'm going to explain the appropriate conception here. Next verse. Karma is like a debt. Erna in Sanskrit especially refers to money owed. You know, when you take out a loan, you have a erna, you have a debt that needs to be repaid. Karma is like a debt for which there is an irrevocable promissory note. The word that I've translated irrevocable is avipranasha. Vipranasha means destroyed or perished. Ah is the negative prefix. So it means something like not destroyed, imperishable, irrevocable, and then promissory note, patra. So here it seems like Nagarjuna is stating his position on how karma works. Karma is like, it's like a debt, okay? He doesn't say it is a debt. He's reverting to metaphor. Or simile, or whatever the hell. It's like a debt. It's like a debt for which there is an irrevocable promissory note. Jason Kapa, in his commentary, Tibetan commentary on this verse, says it's like a loan that's been spent, but which must nevertheless be paid back later with interest. So the spent part of the loan is that, you know, the cause is done, it's gone. Right? You take out a loan and you spend the money. So the money's gone. The cause is gone by the time of the effect. But there nevertheless is the necessity to pay it back. And then he also says, with interest, which is, some of you know, one of the principles of karma, that karma grows, that karma, you know, kind of compounds over time. All right, karma is like a debt for which there is an irrevocable promissory note. It is fourfold in relation to the four realms, but by nature it is neutral. Little technical here, I'll just do it quickly. The four realms talked about are the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm, which if you don't know what they are, you know, it doesn't really matter. They're just these sort of three cosmic realms of the universe according to Buddhist cosmology. And then the fourth one is seems to be referring to nirvana with remainder. Nirvana with remainder is a person, a human being, who has achieved nirvana but has not yet left his or her body yet and is therefore still subject to karma. Because everything physical, everything, you know, kind of in the world of, you know, appearances is subject to karma, to change. So even a person in nirvana who hasn't left their body is subject to karma. But then he says, but by nature it is neutral. Karma is neutral. It means that it isn't no karma. Is inherently good or bad. No karma is inherently good or bad. You know, there are people in our community there, in Cape Ann, who have suffered, you know, recently some very serious health problems. And, you know, all of our, you know, inclinations is to say, well, that's very bad karma for them. You see, they're reaping very bad karma because health problems are bad karma. But health problems or anything else are not inherently bad karma. The bad or goodness of karma, according to, you know, like to the implication here, by saying karma is neutral, depends on the reception. Depends on, you could say, on the interpretation of karma. So a sickness is not, you know, physical problems is not inherently bad karma. It's bad karma if you expect it always to be healthy. And then all of a sudden you're not healthy, and I find this unpleasant. And it is certainly possible, and this is, you know, one of our hopes actually, that karma in terms of its result can be reinterpreted. You see? That it's in our hands, our power, our control, you might say, to say, is there something I can learn from this? Minimally, okay? Is there something good that I can make of this effect? And that's why he says it's neutral. So therefore, you know, in terms of the case of somebody in nirvana with remainder, nirvana while still in their body, they presumably would be, because they're in nirvana, would be able to reinterpret every karma as good. You see? Karma would still be functioning because they're in a body. But because of the, you know, nirvanic mindset, every karmic effect could be reinterpreted into something beneficial and good. All right, moving on. It is not left behind by just relinquishing it. A karmic cause can't just be, kind of left behind, abandoned, just because you don't want it. Okay? Because, like, you look back at your life and you say, oh, I shouldn't have done this thing, I shouldn't have done that thing. And you can't just make it go away by saying, well, I don't want the result of that, please. That's what he's saying, okay? Can't just you know, relinquish it. I don't want this. I had one of my daughters, when she was very young, you know, like 2, 3 maybe, came to my bed one night, I guess it was in the early morning. I was still sleeping. And she has something in her hand, you know? And, she says, Daddy, wake up, Daddy, wake up. And, I said, huh, you know, what? She says, Daddy, I don't want this. And she opened up her hand, and, you know, it was a big turd that, you know, and she said, no, Daddy, I don't want this. Well, I didn't want it either, you know, and she didn't want it, I didn't want it. And karma is kind of like that. You know, you can't just say, I don't want this, you know. Can't just get rid of it like that, okay? Abandonment can only occur through practice, bhavana. Bhavana is sometimes translated as meditation also. It's the word that they use for the fourth of the five paths for you Buddha heads there, the path of habituation, sometimes they translate it as. So you can think of this as practice or habituation. You know, it comes from working. You know, you can get rid of it, but it comes from hard work, not just because you didn't want it anymore. Therefore, the results of action arise through that which is irrevocable. He uses the same word again. So this is another reason why I think it's Nagarjuna's position, is he keeps coming back to this word, irrevocable. Karma is irrevocable, which, you know, means that it works. It definitely works. You can't just, make it go away by, like, intellectualizing it away or by really, really, really wanting to, you know, have a different kind of karma or something like that.
For more information about Lama Marut, please visit www.lamamarut.org.